Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, that's me, ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
June's Journey is a fascinating hidden object mystery gaming app where you'll play as June Parker, tasked with a daunting obligation: solve your sister's murder. Set in the 1920s, the era of glitz and glam, this family mystery is one for the ages. Everyone's a suspect until your investigation determines otherwise. The clues are all around you, hidden within tricky twists and turns. You'll collect detailed information about each character in your photo album, where you'll comb over every detail. You can even join a detectives club to chat and play with others or against them in the detectives league. With hundreds of puzzles to solve, you should probably get started today. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg, presented by Clear. Enroll today at clearme.com/Peter and try Clear at the busiest airports nationwide.
Hi there, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of my Ion Travel Podcast. As more and more Americans hit the road, this is surely looking like the summer we rediscover our own country. And on this episode, I went to Wilmington, Delaware, by Amtrak, to check out a great historic city. Joining me is Wilmington Mayor Mike Pizicki on how COVID-19 has actually accelerated change in the city, not to mention the Biden effect that it's Biden's home state. Then Stephanie Lampkin, the director of the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center for African American Heritage, she's talking about a rich history dating back to 1639, with a few surprises. And if you're looking for true Americana, then look no further than Winterthur. Chris Strand, its executive director, on the almost overwhelming collection the museum possesses. This museum and gardens is so large, it even has its own volunteer fire department. So you know we've got something to talk about. First up, the mayor of Wilmington, Mike Pizicki.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.
Joining me now, the second term mayor of Wilmington, Delaware, Mayor Mike Pizicki. How are you?
Great. Nice to be with you.
You know, when we think of cities in this country right now, you've had a chance, in a sense, and not just Wilmington, but everywhere, to do a reset, to do a do-over because of the pandemic. You can figure out what your goals are, how you can meet them.
Yeah.
In terms of travel and tourism, it's an opportunity for people to, for the first time in a long time, whether they planned it or not, to rediscover their own country.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, it's funny. I think the pandemic has forced all of us to kind of reevaluate all aspects of our lives that we just took for granted were going to be as they always were. And, you know, all of a sudden we find that all the old norms are changing. Kids' attitudes about their obligations are changing. Employees almost feel that working at home is kind of a semi-entitlement in a way. You know, that it's happening so much that people start to ask about working at home as if that ought to be an option that is not questioned by an employer. Employers at the same time are saying, I think I can save a lot of money by reducing the amount of space we have in our rent check every month, so let's start allowing people to stay at home. And that's changing. There was I'm trying to remember the author now, but there's a book called Post-Corona. And the thesis of the book by Scott Galloway was that all the change that was going to take place over the next 10 years has taken place in 1 year. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it. I mean, a year ago, we never would have imagined that telemedicine, distance learning, working at home, all would be kind of normative in the way we deal with them. And so cities are most impacted by this. So, for example, you know, if you've got large educational institutions, you're not sure if kids are coming back or if they're going to be distance learning, and that really impacts local economies. We have a wage tax, as does almost every major city in America, and that wage tax gets impacted when people work at home. They say, I'm sorry, I live over in Maryland somewhere. I don't need to pay a wage tax.
Well, you know, from a travel and tourism perspective, your tax base gets hit hard.
Yeah.
If people aren't going back to work, people are trying to get out of their leases. Commercial office real estate is not exactly thrilling right now.
Don't have to remind me.
I just did. But on another level, and you talk about the 10 years compressed into one, I'm one of those people who actually is betting on the idea that within the next year we may go to a 4-day work week.
Yeah. No, I don't think there is no outrageous idea that shouldn't be considered. You know, it's we've just reevaluated all of our norms. And there's, you know, some of the things you read about is that employees have more strength than they've ever had, more leverage, more strength than they've ever had in our lifetime. I'm looking at you. You're younger, but you're not a whole hell of a lot younger, you know. And so, we've watched these relationships over the years, and it was always employers had the upper hand, and except for strong union periods of time, which have been a long time now, you know, they pretty much set the rules. And now you get the sense that that power has shifted tremendously. And there's kind of a social attitude that's changed. There's clearly a political leverage that employees have. And in the real world, employers can't find employees, so they're running around trying to do everything they can to keep them happy.
And we're seeing mobility at rates we've never seen before.
Absolutely.
People absolutely are traveling, true. But they're traveling, they're leaving.
Yeah, they are. There's no, well, you know, there are, of course, now the cities around America are saying, if you're gonna work away from the office, live here. We'll pay you $10,000 to live here. I forget. Did I just see Tulsa is paying paying a fortune for people to go live? Come, if you're gonna work distance, be here.
You know, Barbados did it. I mean, the honorable said, "We'll give you a 1-year visa. Just come out and hang out here."
Yeah. So who would have imagined? Who would have imagined when this all started that these things would have happened at a scale that promised in some measure to upend our kind of normal, our social norms.
Well, speaking of upending, if we were talking a year ago, Wilmington was just Wilmington. Now it's the home of the President of the United States.
You know, there have only been 46 and we got one. And he's a real special guy. He called me the other day. We had an unfortunate incident with some of our police officers getting shot. And the President of the United States called me up and asked me about them and how they're doing. And we talked about a whole bunch of things. The President and I shared a dormitory. We both lived in the same dormitory back in the dark ages when we were both in school.
And by the way, let me just put this in perspective. The population of Wilmington is 70,000.
72,000 people, yeah.
Everybody knows everybody.
Everybody, yeah. Yeah, there's a little saying that we use about everybody, you know, probably can't repeat it here, but it's, you know, everybody's related, everybody dated, you know, that kind of thing. And so everybody does know everybody. I knew Jill before, I knew
so
Joe
you know
before
the,
I knew Joe. I
so mean, you know just, the secret history of his dormitory behavior.
Well, I must tell you, the funny thing about the President of the United States is when we were in school together, I was a football player, and I would roll out of bed in the morning looking like I just got out of the hamper. And every time I saw Joe Biden, he always looked like he was going on a job interview. And I was thinking, like, who is this guy? You know, he's just a guy that was always prepared for, he was trying to meet his ambition. And that's just Joe's who he has always been. He's also the greatest retail politician right there with Bill Clinton, I guess, that, you know, anybody's ever seen. He's just when you meet with him, you feel like you're the only other person in the room. And that's when the secret of his extraordinary success. And I would never bet on Joe being able to do what he did. And I'm in awe of the fact that he did it. I mean, and I told him that the other day. I said, I cannot imagine. So, and I also, on days when I'm sitting here whining about how difficult my job is, I think of Joe Biden, who is 3 years older than I am. And instead of tackling one relatively small city, he's dealing with the entire world.
Well, speaking of upending, now that he's president, how has that impacted Wilmington?
It's transformed us in so many ways. First of all, you know, stature is a function of perception. And I think people look at Wilmington as for years we looked at Wilmington as the corporate capital, the chemical capital, right?
The banks were here, the corporations
banks,
were incorporated
credit card
here.
Capital. That's right. So there was kind of a mystique about it. But then all of a sudden, now you're the home of Joe Biden. And now there's there's a mystique and a curiosity, and you know, there's just this kind of subtle elevation of our, I guess, of our brand, and people think of us in a different way, and we.
How are they thinking of you in a different way?
You know, I think good question. It's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to say. It's just that we get calls from people we never got called from before. So, for example, we have investors coming into the city at a higher rate than ever before. That's not just because of Joe Biden, I don't know, but it certainly didn't hurt. All of a sudden, there's a credibility to the city that I'm not sure people were aware of. We are always that city between New York and D.C. on 995 somewhere, and now we get people coming by and wanting to invest. You take a look around the city.
By the way, your branding message is not we're on I-95
somewhere. No, that's true. It's kind of its time. You know, it's time for everybody to recognize this great little city that we have here. And, it, you know, we're like any other city. We're not without our problems. But when people come to visit here, they generally are surprised at what an attractive city it is, how clean the city is. You drive around, you go, you know, there's not a lot of trash on this place. It looks pretty nice and clean, and there are a lot of beautiful parks and public places.
And you've maintained the older architecture.
We have. Yeah, there's no question about it. So you may know that I was the director of the Riverfront Development Corporation for 20 years. That started in 1996. I went through 2016, so a full 20 years. And it was just an old, dilapidated World War II shipyard that has had to date about $1.25 billion of investment. And it is really, it's been transformed tremendously. And it's a nice addition to our urban core, our downtown. For years, we kept talking about the spine of these two areas, having a common spine so that people would just, there'd be a continuum between the two.
When we talk about your location, mm-hmm. you have an airport. I've actually flown into it, but privately. Mm-hmm. But now you're going to get some air service back, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you had Delta here, but they left.
Yeah, we had, from time to time, we have somebody.
We're talking about Newcastle, right?
Yeah, it's Newcastle Airport right nearby. And from time to time, someone says we can make an economic go of having an airport that is within a half hour less of Philadelphia Airport. And for whatever reason, and I can't tell you why, it just hasn't worked in the past. But we've got somebody else coming back again.
And, yeah, Frontier.
Frontier's going to come back and try it. Do this again, and we're happy for that. You know, it's just gives us another opportunity for people to come in and out of this. I don't understand the economics of that industry. It baffles
me
how
they
can make it.
The industry doesn't understand the economics
well,
of that industry.
Because, you know, it's hard to figure out how you make it work for $90 a ticket or something like that. But
can I tell you how they make it work for $90 a ticket? Yeah. Here it is. Airline tickets get taxed at a huge federal excise tax. So if I sell you a ticket for $1, but I charge you $300 for your bag, the bag doesn't get charged at federal excise tax. The bag gets charged at local state taxes. I'm making a lot of money.
I wonder if I can figure out how to do that in the city here. What can I slip past the goalie here?
That's right. Gas at $1 a gallon, but parking is $700.
Yeah, there you go.
See, you're in. Or maybe not. But I didn't come in by plane this time. I came in on Amtrak. Of course,
good.
I arrived at the Joe Biden station. When was that named after him?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to think. It's within the last 10 years, I think.
Because he was called Amtrak. Joe still is for a reason.
Well, it's interesting. He and Tom Carper both spent,
our senator spent
every day on the train. So we're a train town. Joe likes to remind everybody, you know, we have always been a train town. And we were once the ninth busiest train station in America. So, we really depend on train travel. And it's always, you know, it's kind of funny every time I listen to this debate about whether they should support Amtrak. I don't understand how you're a grown-up country and not support a really vibrant rail system.
Well, to put this in context, and we forget about this all the time, the trains built America. You know, Dwight Eisenhower said when he was president, you know, we didn't build the interstates, the interstates built America. Mm-hmm. That was right, but before that, had to come the trains, and that's what did it.
You talked about history before.
We used to tell time by trains. It was called railroad time.
Right.
If we told time by trains today, we would never even do the show on time.
Well, I think that's funny. And remember, they had all the different time zones, too. I mean, it wasn't just the three or four time zones that we have today. There were time zones all over the place. But the story of the railroads is remarkable. The story of the overbuilding of the railroads, the story of the boom and bust of the railroads in the late 1800s. And, I mean, it's a fascinating story. And it's the amount of people who lost money betting on railroads was another story all by itself. But
and, you know, we have to put that in perspective because if you take a look at just the ridership numbers that Amtrak's had, mm-hmm. Let's not talk about service mm-hmm. or schedule, but just their ridership numbers, they're an essential link.
They are, and what's remarkable is it's not inexpensive. You know, I mean, it's especially if you go first class. You know, it gets pretty pricey, but still very, very important. And it seems to me that should be a priority when you talk about infrastructure. That should be an essential part of our infrastructure discussion.
Well, that brings up high-speed trains because we're the only country in the world that really doesn't have it.
No, I know.
You know, because the tracks are controlled by the freight lines, and they could care less about high speed. Mm-hmm. And yet, here in the Northeast Corridor, this is the one area of the country that Amtrak actually makes a profit, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Between Boston and D.C. And yet they can buy all the train stock they want, but if they can't fix the tracks, we're not going anywhere.
Yeah, it seems silly. And it falls in the same category as our bridges and our roads and the number of those, that infrastructure that's really substandard in a country like ours, it makes your head hurt some days.
For people who've never been to Wilmington, and let's just say I haven't been. Of course,
right.
I have.
Right.
But if I came into town today, what would be the one thing that would surprise me the most?
It's funny. I think of it, surprise you the most. I think people have preconceived notions about cities as such. You know, it's a, and so all cities feel, they have a big city feel for good and for bad. You go to Philadelphia, you know, it's a nice city, but you drive through the city and you find that some of the streets are almost impassable. I don't mean to be disrespectful to my neighbor up the street, but it seems some parts of it are really nice and some of it look like they need to put more money in the maintenance of the city or the cleaning of the city or whatever it is. It seems that there's a density and a little bit of a rough edge to it in some places. You come to Wilmington, everything is in really pretty good repair wherever you go. You know, the things that our neighbors complain about, really just minor problems for the calls you get in the middle of the night about a pothole on a road or something
like that.
So
basically when they call to complain, you tell them to go to check out Philadelphia.
I don't want to get
disrespectful. It's okay.
I don't want to get a call from Jim Kenney. But yeah, you know, the bigger cities for their appeal, they also have a real downside. I can't even imagine what it's like to be the mayor of a city that size and deal with all the problems. Here, what is different about Wilmington is I literally, honestly, can walk my entire city in an afternoon.
We talked about the city itself, infrastructure, systems, but let's talk about specifics. If I'm coming for the first time, and I'm going to ask you to give me your favorites here, where am I going for breakfast? Where am I going for lunch? Where are you taking me for dinner? And what are you going to surprise me with?
Oh, yeah, okay. You know, my favorite restaurant in the city is Bardea. It's right up on, right over on Market Street. They're new about the last 2 or 3 years.
And I didn't know you were going to say that, but I had dinner there last night,
well,
and it was great.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah. I did.
And here's something to know about Wilmington. You asked me about breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a Cozy Corner guy forever up on Union Street.
All right, and what am I going to find in Cozy Corner?
Oh, it's just a steak and eggs place. I mean, it's not too special. It's so basic that that's its endearing quality. You know, there's nothing fancy about it. It's just the perfect little place to sit and have breakfast.
So basically, you can walk in there and say, I'll have the regular.
Yeah, there you go. And then down on the riverfront, there's some real nice restaurants. And so lunch treats, you know, Iron Hill, Big Fish, they're great restaurants, do very, very well. And I'm very proud of them because I honestly crafted each lease and financed each building. And so it's been a...
So you have no difficulty getting a reservation?
No, I don't. One of the few advantages. The thing we talked about before that I failed to say was people come visit Wilmington. And they will say, I love this about Wilmington, and I'll find it that it's outside the borders of the city. It's out in the county. Well, you know, Wilmington as such is a larger footprint than the city. You know, so you know, even Longwood Gardens, which is up the road, people think of as part of Wilmington. It's a big, you know, a DuPont company product right across the line in Pennsylvania. Winnetour and Hagley are these are all outside the city, but they all have Wilmington addresses. So people just say that's Wilmington. And frankly, it makes perfectly good sense to do so. There's nobody who says, whoops, that's a dividing line. So you're outside the city. You don't get credit for that. It's, you know, all part of a big, the same whole, you know.
So I'm going to give you freedom for 3 hours. You have 3 hours free in Wilmington. Where are you going?
Well, I personally, I love the riverfront. I love going down to the Russell Peterson Wildlife Refuge. I don't know if you've been there yet, but it's a beautiful destination. It's at the end of a 2 mile river walk, which has been extended another 6 miles to go into Old Newcastle. It's a beautiful walk for people like to bike and to bike or to just take a long walk, obviously, to 7 or 8 miles. That's a treat. You should never miss Hagley. You should never miss Winnetur. And while you're in the neighborhood, you know, you ought to get up to Longwood and see what that world-renowned garden is. And then the city itself is, you know, there are just so many nice places to go. There's so many nice restaurants and sources of nightlife, the Queen Theater. Those kinds of things are really, we have choices today we never had before. Let me just say, Wilmington was a corporate town forever. It was a DuPont corporate town. It was DuPont.
It was truly a company town.
Oh, it was an unbelievable. And it was more than company town. It was a corporate town. And by corporate, I mean kind of stiff collar. You know, I worked for IBM in the old days, and they would say you have to wear a dark suit, a white shirt, and a sincere tie and 12-pound wingtip shoes. I mean, that was kind of the uniform. And if you wore a blue shirt, my boss would ask me, when was I working at the gas station? You know, that kind of thing, like the Sunoco thing. Well, I think that
corporate... You're really dating yourself when you say Sunoco.
Yeah,
you know
yeah, of course. I don't like how you do it all day long. I'm old. But, you know, but that corporate culture kind of defined the city. So it wasn't an artistically daring city. It just was kind of a staid group. And then as the DuPont company lost its influence and ultimately left the city itself, Hercules left, MBNA came and then went, we had Bank of America, you're starting to see the city grow up in a way that is really exciting. It's young people defining what the city looks like. It's the kind of things you see in big cities all over the country. And that's what my hope is. That's what my aspiration is, that we get the crazy kids going out there and doing what kids do and, you know, daring with their art and their music and their fun and their inventiveness. That's what you want in a city. That's what cities are.
And doing all the things you did in the dorm with Joe Biden.
Correct. Well, what I did, he didn't do it.
Well, have the statute of limitations expired on that?
I think they have.
So you're free now.
Yeah, definitely free.
Okay.
My thanks to Mayor Pazicki. Delaware may have been one of the original 13, but along with that distinction comes its own African-American history. Stephanie Lampkin takes us back to the future, starting in 1639.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
We are in Wilmington, Delaware. In fact, at the Hotel DuPont here in Wilmington, a hotel that is over 108 years old and has done really well. But if you're a history buff, you know that, you know, Wilmington in Delaware, one of the original 13 colonies, guess what? The history still lives on. And joining me now is somebody who knows a little bit about that history. She's the director of the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center for African American Heritage, Dr. Stephanie Lampkin. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I look around, I can walk probably 40 feet from this hotel, and you'd have something to tell me about the history of this city as it relates to the African American experience.
That's right. So down at the Delaware Historical Society, one of the newest parts of the organization is the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center for African American Heritage. We opened in October 2016, and we have a core exhibit called Journey to Freedom, which explores Delaware's African American history from 1639 to the present.
You know, we were just in Selma, Montgomery, Alabama, doing this show, and we were at the Dexter Avenue Church where Martin Luther King preached. And I'm old enough to remember when a lot of those churches were getting burned to the ground. during the civil rights movement. And the preacher there said to me, take a look at where we are. We didn't get burned down. I said, was that because Martin Luther King was preaching? He said, no, just the opposite. We were so close to the state capitol, it was too close. They couldn't, they were just worried about burning everything down, right? And then he said, no, look up the street. And there's the Capitol building. He said, that building was built by slaves. And so much of the architecture, so much of the building to this day contains that history.
That's correct. And actually, when you walk through our exhibit, we do feature a segment called Wilmington 1968. And speaking of Martin Luther King Jr., after his assassination, there was a 9-month occupation by the National Guard in the city of Wilmington. And that may sound surprising.
Wait, that does sound surprising because Wilmington is not a big city.
It's not.
So why were they occupying?
So it seemed to be a pretty extreme reaction, at least when we look at the documentation of those who experienced that moment. But as a result of the assassination, there were protests as well as peaceful demonstrations that took place in Wilmington. The reaction was quite strong. And so our exhibition, you can see the photographs as well as the headlines and the media coverage of how people reacted in that moment. You can also see oral histories as well of people remembering what it was like in Wilmington under that occupation for 9 months.
Well, I will speak for myself. I was alive in 1968, and I remember that after that assassination, that the National Guard was deployed all over the country. And it was like it was a hammer. The hammer came down as American cities literally erupted, right? But when you think about where we are here in terms of Wilmington's history in America, in terms of the development of this as a country, how many American presidents were slave owners?
Excellent point. And we challenge people to ask themselves these questions, especially with the state of Delaware being the first state. One of the things that stands out in our exhibition is you'll get surprised by some of the facts in terms of the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. We're not ratified in Delaware until 1901. So when you think about some of the timeline that we're looking at for Delaware's African-American history, you'll find a number of surprising facts.
And of course, given what's happened in the last 6 or 7 years, I can go another 60 feet from this hotel and there's no longer a statue sitting up there. Tell me about that.
That's correct. So last year, during the number of social justice protests that occurred throughout 2020, one of the statues here in the city, a statue of Caesar Rodney, was actually...
Well, that's Rodney Square.
Yes. Was actually removed as a result of asking these questions.
Now, he was considered a patriot. He was considered one of the fathers of the country, if you will, even though he wasn't one of the original presidents, right?
That's correct. And an enslaver as well. So,
whoops. there's that. Yep.
So now that we're asking ourselves these questions, you know, who writes history? You know, who has the right to tell these stories? And how are these stories being preserved and shared?
Well, actually, I'll give you a better question. Who rewrites history? Because, you know, you read the textbooks of the 50s, then you read the textbooks of the 80s telling the exact same story. Not exactly, right?
You're right.
So how are we rewriting history now?
So our exhibition, Journey to Freedom, when we think about projects like the 1619 Project, right? Our story starts in 1639, and we highlight things at the Underground Railroad and even Delaware's place in that narrative as being one of the more significant contributions to the state's history.
Not to mention Harriet Tubman.
That's right.
Now, how does she involve herself in Delaware?
Absolutely. So we actually held an event last year with our partners down in Dover, which is one of the cities connected to the Underground Railroad and Harriet Tubman's story. So it was an excellent opportunity for us to share that history as well as work with our partners.
You know, so much of great travel experiences has to do with storytelling and who's telling the story and how well they tell the story. What's the story that you tell that surprises your visitors the most?
So for us, there is a story to be told. And I think incorporating that into some of the landmarks that you see throughout the state, some of the historic homes, historic properties, we're working hard to continue to collect that story, continue with research, building our collections related to Delaware's African-American experience, and also creating events for the public where we can share this new research that we're finding.
Can you do a walking tour as well?
You can. can. So if you are interested in learning more about Market Street, you can certainly...
And by the way, Market Street is right here, where we are right now.
Yes. You can sign up through the Delaware History Museum to take a tour of it points out the historic, some of the buildings and businesses.
Because if you and I were to go walking down Market Street right now, so much of that architecture, so many of those buildings have been preserved. They go back 100 or 200 years. Every one of those buildings tells a story.
That's correct. And actually, the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage is part of the larger Delaware Historical Society, which includes the Delaware History Museum, Old Town Hall, Willingtown Square, and the Research Library. And those are all historic buildings.
And after I come out and hang with you, and after I leave my experience with you, what's the one enduring message you want me to leave with?
We always encourage our visitors to see themselves in the history that we're sharing. So while our focus is Delaware...
That's asking a lot, by the way. No, it is.
It is. Yeah. And while our focus is Delaware's African-American history, there are many themes that will resonate with our visitors. Sometimes they even literally see themselves in the historic photos that we have featured in the exhibit. And it brings about a memory that they then share with us that connects them to the history we're sharing.
Are you guys also working on an oral history project as well?
We certainly feature oral histories in our exhibition, and we are working to do more of that kind of work. That's something that's really passionate about through the Mitchell Center.
My thanks to Stephanie. Now think about 1.5 square miles of museum and gardens and an eccentric collector named Henry Francis DuPont. Yes, from that DuPont family. And then get ready. More than 90,000 unique Americana items on display, textiles, ceramics, and especially furniture. Chris Strand, the executive director of Winterthur, has his work cut out for him. One of the reasons why you come to Wilmington is because it's such a manageable destination and it offers so much. One of the things that it offers is probably the premier museum of American decorative arts. They've got an unparalleled collection of nearly 90,000 objects, I counted every one of them, made or used in America since, get this, 1640. And joining me now from the Winterthur Museum is Chris Stand. How are you, Chris?
Very good. Thanks, Peter.
That's a staggering number.
It is.
You could probably rotate that exhibit for the next 35 decades.
It would be hard to see it all, that's for sure.
So what is it that, you know, that is particularly American that you are being able to show people that they had no idea about?
Well, you know, if you walk into the DuPont dining room and look on the sideboard there, there's six Paul Revere tankards. And I don't know if you can see six Paul Revere tankards anywhere else in the world.
Most people haven't even seen one.
Right. Mr. DuPont was collecting these items when maybe American decorative arts weren't the most appreciated. So he was able to assemble a very sort of unique and really probably unparalleled collection.
And the other thing is, when you think about a museum, you think about a structure, a brick building. We're talking a lot of land.
We are. We're about 1.5 square miles. So
You've got meadows and woodlands and ponds and waterways, animals too.
Absolutely. So if you drive in the main entrance gate, you'll see merino sheep grazing on the front pasture, make your way down into the property, and ultimately see the house, which is 175 rooms, which is what contains
that
collection.
Excuse me one second. How many rooms?
Right. 175.
What's the heating bill?
I don't even want to talk about it. You're right. I mean, heating and cooling and storing and dusting, and imagine your own house, now multiply it by 100.
But this was formerly, it was DuPont time.
Absolutely. You know, they've lived there since the 1830s and started in a fairly modest house by our standards, 17 rooms, and it grew over time to be 175.
Talk about an add-on. Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely.
They were constantly adding on, right?
They were, and Mr. DuPont was probably the most extraordinary, reshaper of the property in adding the house and the barns and the agriculture, as well as the 77-acre garden.
And he was a collector.
That's sort of an understatement.
It went way beyond Paul Revere.
Absolutely.
What was his biggest collection?
That's a good question. You know, he started as a young man collecting, and if you look through the museum, it's everything from ceramics and textiles, paintings, as well as furniture. I think we're known for the extraordinary furniture among furniture collectors. But I think
for example, I go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have the American Wing, and
right.
You see the original colonial furniture there. You see it here, too.
Absolutely. Actually, he put it together in sort of composition. So every room is this sort of unique composition. Whereas you go to a big museum, you're sort of looking at an item. At Winterthur, you go into a room and you may have 250 objects.
So he's actually staged the room.
He did. Yeah,
he was the original house stager.
There are little brass tacks in the floor that you can still see, which is where he wanted the furniture placed.
Really?
Yeah.
But he had the real estate to play with.
He did. And play is maybe a good way of describing it, because I have the feeling that his entire life was spent playing with these items, playing with the estate, and trying to create something beautiful.
I'm assuming that he also had somewhat of a sense of humor, or at least in terms of adventure, in rearranging things or surprising you with things.
He did. You know, I think that to many people, the house itself is a bit of a surprise. If you look at it from the outside, it doesn't look like 175 rooms. It's 9 stories from the lowest level to the top, and it barely looks like
a
9
stories
building.
In a state of Delaware, given the time he did this, was unprecedented.
Absolutely.
I'm amazed. Quite frankly, I'm amazed it didn't burn down.
Well, he was very fearful of fire. We have our own fire company.
There you go. It's still to this day?
To this day. We still have a volunteer fire department.
Well, I'm a volunteer fireman, so I got to go check those guys out.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be great.
Unbelievable. But then you have the gardens.
Yes. I guess people don't really realize he was trained as a horticulturist. So he studied at Harvard University to become a horticulturist, and he returned to the estate and created this amazing garden in addition to the collection.
How big is the garden?
Well, technically it's 77 acres, but we sort of look at it as the entire 1,000 acres.
Because you're working it all the time.
Absolutely.
And the biggest surprise in that garden?
Maybe the biggest surprise is that, you know, if you visit other gardens, you're used to seeing tulips and annuals and that sort of thing. We maybe have one pickup load of change out in the display a year. Everything that you see in the garden comes back year after year and has done since Mr. DuPont's death in 1969.
And how many people have to work to maintain all this?
Well, at its peak, when he was alive, he had 89 horticulturists. I wish I had that today.
89 horticulturists just for the gardens?
Yes.
Wow.
And today we have 18. So we have some very busy horticulturists.
All right. So I asked how much the heating bill was. How much is the water bill?
Well, one thing that's interesting about Winitor is that we actually we produce our own water. We actually produce about 1 million gallons of water a day for the Brandywine right off the estate.
How are you doing that?
It's basically unbounded groundwater. So one of the reasons we're a nature preserve is to protect the water quality of the Brandywine.
It's impossible for anybody to see all 175 rooms in one visit, 2 visits, 10 visits, 20 visits. How long did it take you?
It's taken me, I've been there 16 years, and I'm embarrassed to say I probably haven't seen every room.
You're serious?
Yeah.
So probably there are a couple of bodies buried there you haven't discovered.
Well, and I just don't know if someone sits in the chairs or sleeps in the beds. I'm sure they don't, but I would love to see every room.
Everybody has a rumor about it being haunted, is it?
I don't think so, but there are a couple spots when you take the tour that definitely the guides have said, be careful when you're in this spot. It's a little spooky.
So the rumors are true?
Oh, there's definitely a lot of rumors at Winitor.
Or the truth about the rumors.
Right. There are folk tales that go back many, many generations.
When you go there, and you're there every day, what's the feeling that you get?
It is the best commute you could ever want. Driving into the estate and sort of winding your way in, you can feel your blood pressure go down immediately.
And it's open to the public?
Yes. You know, we allow our members to come almost every day of the year. And we do close briefly for 2 months to do a lot of maintenance and so forth to the general public.
But for the general public, people listening to my show right now, how do they access it?
I think the easiest way is to visit our website. If you visit it's winitor.org.
And you're a nonprofit.
Absolutely. We support 2 graduate programs. We do conservation for objects from around the world. We're a nonprofit with a very philanthropic mission.
And the other thing is, you know, you mentioned 175 rooms. You also have 118 buildings.
Yeah, I know. That's part of our cross to bear. And some of them are, for example, the dairy barn is a remarkable dairy barn, but we don't have a dairy herd anymore. So we use it for storage and we allow people to visit it because it's a beautiful building.
Chris, you need cows.
We do.
My thanks to Chris Strand, to Stephanie Lampkin, and to Wilmington, Delaware Mayor Mike Pizicki. And my thanks to you for listening to this Ion Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news updates, it's an easy choice to make. Just log on to petergreenberg.com.
Special thanks to our sponsors at Clear. Enroll in Clear at clearme.com/Peter and zip through busy airports nationwide.
Hey, Prime members, Peter Greenberg here. You can listen to Ion Travel ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, and you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. And before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at Wondery.com.
The chilling new original docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.